Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in 2 Kings chapter 7. I'm going to do the entire chapter, verses 1 through 20, and we will call this chapter The Siege of Samaria is Lifted. Our context is this. In the last chapter, at the end of the chapter, we see the Syrian army under Ben-Hadad II, has besieged Samaria, and there's a horrible famine, and a woman was complaining because she made a pact with another woman to eat their sons in the famine, and the other woman ate the first woman's son first and then didn't cough up her son to be eaten, and it got so bad that the king tore his clothes. Sackcloth was underneath because he was miserable. He says, I'm going to get you, Elijah, for this. He goes to Elijah. Elijah says, hey, it's not my fault. Now, that's the context. We're in the middle of a bunch of miracles that Elijah has done, and it's all during the reign of King Joram, most probably. King Joram ruled from 852 to 841 B.C. This is the time of Elisha. So we start now with 2 Kings chapter 7, verse 1. Then Elisha said, listen to the word of the Lord. Thus says the Lord, tomorrow about this time a measure of fine flour will be sold for a shekel, and two measures of barley for a shekel in the gate of Samaria. Now what Elisha is doing is vindicating himself. He had already been charged that he was not doing anything to help the famine. In the last chapter, 2 Kings chapter 6, verse 31, Joram had said, may God punish me and do so severely if the head of Elisha, son of Shaphat, remains on his shoulders today. In other words, I will take his head off, and if I don't, you can take my head off. He was quite upset with Elijah. Why? Well, nobody knows for sure. Maybe because Elijah warned about the famine coming and they want to kill the messenger. Or maybe they're thinking Elisha has so much power as a prophet he could stop the famine. But for whatever reason, Elisha has to defend himself. Remember, Joram had sent messengers to kill Elisha as he's sitting in his house with elders, probably the elders of Israel, some of whom had been converted to Yahweh. And the messengers come in saying, Joram is very upset with you, Elisha. And so now Elisha responds. Now, it's questionable who he was addressing. He could have been addressing the elders who were sitting with him in the house, who then told the king's messengers, who then reported it back to Joram. Or, since Joram had followed the messengers, it could be that Elisha speaking to the king directly, which I think it makes, dramatically speaking, it makes it better if he's speaking to the Joram directly. And Elisha gives them some incredibly good news. Tomorrow, 24 hours from now or so, a measure of fine flour will be sold for a shekel, two measures of barley for a shekel. Fine flour is wheat. Wheat was twice as expensive as barley, so you could get twice as much barley for one shekel, but that's reasonable prices. You recall that the price level had shot sky high during the famine. In the last chapter, verse 25, 2 Kings 6, we read this. So there was a great famine in Samaria, and they continued the siege against it until a donkey's head sold for 80 silver shekels, and a cup of dove's dung sold for 5 shekels. So, during the famine, they had to spend 80 shekels to get a donkey's head. After the famine, in one day, they will send 1 shekel and get a measure of wheat, which is 6 or 7 quarts. So, 80 shekels for a donkey's head and 1 shekel for 6 or 7 quarts of wheat. So, the price level will have shrunk dramatically in one day. Also during the famine, if you recall, a cup of dove's dung, a cup is, nobody knows exactly how much that is. Some people say it's a half an ounce. Some people say it's 2 ounces. It's a cab, a K-A-B, and they don't know exactly how to translate the measure. But the point is, however much it was, it wasn't much, and it was dove's dung, and it sold for 5 silver shekels. 5 times the amount for a cup of dove's dung, which you could buy for buying a measure of wheat, which you could spend to buy a measure of wheat. So you see, this is quite a pronouncement that Elisha has made. Now, this selling will be done in the gate of Samaria, verse 1. That's where all transactions took place, judicial, and also, I guess they did a little trading out there, too, at the gate. We go to verse 2, 2 Kings 7. Then the captain, the king's right-hand man, responded to the man of God, responded to Elisha, look, even if the Lord were to make windows in heaven, could this really happen? Elisha announced, you will in fact see it with your own eyes, but you won't eat any of it. Now, of course, this is a poetic expression. The captain comes up with windows in heaven, open the windows, and out comes the grain. Well, the man of God is not going to get to eat any of this grain that Elisha confidently predicts will come, and the lesson that we learn from this. It is not wise to figure out how God is going to fulfill his promises. If somebody who knows the Lord and you can trust says, hey, it's going to happen, don't worry about how it's going to happen. Just be thankful that it will happen. Now, Elisha announced to this captain, you're not going to eat any of this grain. Well, there's a couple of ways you can look at this. One, you can say, well, that's his punishment for not believing. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown takes it this way. They say, quote, the scoffing infidelity of this remark, which was a sneer against not the prophet only, but the God he served, was justly and signally punished. When we get down to verse 20 at the end of this chapter in this audio, we will see this. This is what happened to him. The people trampled him in the gateway and he died, so he's going to die. And just punishment, says Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, because he doubted the word of the prophet. However, there's another way you can look at it. This is Adam Clark's view. Quote, any person in his circumstances might have spoken as he did. In other words, this was not punishment. It was just wonder. My goodness, are you saying that the prices are going to drop that drastically and we're going to be supplied? That's impossible. Now, Adam Clark says this. Now, Adam Clark is an Arminian, and he cannot bring it upon himself to think that anybody is punished. Arminians just have a hard time with that. They don't want to make God look unfair or unjust. Calvinists tend to say, hey, God's just. He can do what he wants to do. Well, I'm not an Arminian, but in this case, I really think Clark's right. I don't think the man was scoffing and mocking God. I think he was just expressing surprise. Well, I'll report. You decide. We go now to 2 Kings chapter 7, verses 3 through 7. Now there were four leprous men at the entrance of the gate, and they said to one another, why do we sit here until we die? If we say we will enter the city, then the famine is in the city, and we will die there. And if we sit here, we die also. The here is outside the gate. The gate is at the very in the wall at the front of the city of Samaria, and the lepers were close to the wall outside of the gate, outside of the city. So the lepers continue, now therefore come, talking to themselves, now therefore come and let us go over to the camp of the Arameans. If they spare us, we will live, and if they kill us, we will but die. In other words, they're saying, we haven't got anything to lose. If we'll go into the city, we're going to die there. There's no food there. They weren't supposed to go into the city, but they could have forced their way in. They could have walked in. So they've got nothing left to lose. So verse 5, they arose at twilight to go to the camp of the Arameans. When they came to the outskirts of the camp of the Arameans, behold, there was no one there. For the Lord had caused the army of the Arameans to hear a sound of chariots and a sound of horses, even the sound of a great army, so that they said to one another, behold, the king of Israel has hired against us the kings of the Hittites and the kings of the Egyptians to come upon us. Therefore they arose and fled in the twilight, and left their tents and their horses and their donkeys, even the camp just as it was, and fled for their life. Now in verse 3, there were four lepers at the entrance of the gate. Why were they there? Well, the law said that they had to stay outside the camp, and so that's probably why they were outside the city at the time. We read this in Leviticus 13, verse 46. He, the leper, shall remain unclean all the days during which he has the infection. He is unclean. He shall live alone. His dwelling shall be outside the camp. So they're living outside the camp, but they wanted to be as close to the city as they could get. So they went to the wall of the city near the gate. They wanted to do that because they wanted to run from the Arameans, the Syrians. They were scared of them. Also, they might figure that somebody might have mercy on them and give them some relief, some food from the city, although there wasn't any food there. So maybe they were thinking there was food there, but there wasn't. And if they decided to go even further than outside the gate, but if they had entered the gate and gone into the city, if they decided they were going to run from the Arameans, well, who's going to complain about that? Well, we got lepers in the city. Do you think that people who are dying of the plague are going to worry about lepers? Do we think that people who are about to undergo a military attack and destruction of the city, they're not going to worry about lepers? So it makes sense the lepers were where they were. So the lepers, instead of going into the city, went toward the Syrians. They got into their camp, and lo and behold, there was nobody there. Why had they left? Well, they had heard something that made them think that the Israelites had gotten a lot of foreign allies, namely Hittites and Egyptians, in such number as to overwhelm the Arameans, and so they got out of town. Now, this was some kind of a miracle, as Jameson, Fawcett, Brown say. The miracle was either in the air, there was an objective sound in the air, or the miracle was in their ears, in which case the miracle would be subjective. This is according to Poole. Either way, whether it was objectively or sub- objectively true in the air or subjectively experienced in the ears. Either way, it was a miracle, as Colin Delitzsch say. Cambridge commentator says we are not told, nor is it intended for us to know exactly how this miracle happened. Benson says that the air was put into the motion by the ministry of angels. Well, I don't know. We got the God who's the God of the oceans, the air, the climate, the weather. He's the God of everything. He could have just made a good windstorm blow through the area, and that would produce the sound of armies marching, seems to me. Either way, if it was a natural explanation, the timing would make it miraculous. And so, once again, God has spoken to the prophet, and then God operates in order to make the words of the prophet come true. Now, it seems a little bit strange that Hittites would be mentioned here. Remember there, if you look it up in Wikipedia, if I've done this about 10 times, my memory tells me that they lasted till about 1200 or so B.C. It was a major ancient empire. It was mainly centered in present-day Turkey, Anatolia. But pockets of Hittites remained for a long time. Remember, Uriah was a Hittite, and that's in the early 900s. When Uriah the Hittite was killed, well, that's after 1200. So, again, he was from the remnant of the Hittites. Let me read you what the pulpit commentary says about this. Quote, "This supposition has been thought strange that there were Hittites around, almost inexplicable." Quoting a Mr. Sumner, "No such nation as the Hittites any longer existed," unquote, says Mr. Sumner. But the Assyrian records of the 9th and 8th centuries B.C. make it evident not only that Hittites still existed at that date, but that they were among the most powerful enemies of the Ninevite kings, the Assyrians, being located in northern Syria about Carchemish, that's on the Euphrates in northern Syria, and the adjacent country. So even the Assyrian records tell us that Hittites were hanging around there in Syria. It is also apparent, pulpit continues, that they did not form a centralized monarchy, but were governed by a number of chiefs or kings, 12 of whom are mentioned in one place. It was no very improbable supposition on the part of the Syrians that Joram had called in the aid of the Hittite Confederacy and that they had marched an army to his assistance. We go down to 2 Kings chapter 7, verses 8 through 11. "When these lepers came to the outskirts of the camp, they entered one tent and ate and drank, and carried from there silver and gold and clothes, and went and hid them. And they returned and entered another tent and carried from there also, and went and hid them. Then they said to one another, 'We are not doing right. This day is a day of good news, but we are keeping silent. If we wait until morning light, punishment will overtake us.'" Smart thinking. "Now therefore come, let us go and tell the king's household." So they came and called to the gatekeepers of the city, and they told them, saying, "We came to the camp of the Arameans, and behold, there was no one there, nor the voice of man, only the horses tied and the donkeys tied in the tents just as they were." The gatekeepers called and told it within the king's household. Now the lepers, the first thing they did when they saw the undisturbed camp of the Arameans, they ate and drank. Why? Because they were starving to death. Well, after they ate and drank, then they said, "Well, let's get rich. Silver and gold and clothes. This is probably the money carried by the officers. I'm sure they carried money so they could purchase things if they needed to on their trip from Syria." So the lepers are thinking, "Boy, our ship has come in. We're not only are we not starving to death, but we're going to be rich." Not bad for lepers. But then they started thinking, "Well, wait a minute. Sooner or later, it's going to be discovered that the Syrians aren't out here anymore. And when they discover that, and they found out somehow that we've been pillaging the tents, we are going to be in deep doo-doo. Joram is really going to come after us." And so they decided they better tell Joram about what they saw out there. They decided to be a little more patriotic and a little less greedy. Now, some people say the punishment they're worried about is the Syrians coming back, or the Syrians that were slow in leaving might turn around and get them, but I don't think so. I think they're worried about what Joram's going to do. So they go to the gatekeepers. They tell the gatekeepers, "Hey, there's nobody out here anymore, nothing to worry about." And the gatekeepers go and wake Joram up and tell him. Told it within the king's household, and then some of the king's servants would then go wake him up and tell him. Now in verse 10, we see the horses were tied up. And my question is this, why would the Syrians leave their horses? It seems like they could get away quicker if they were on horses. Well, Cambridge, I think, has the answer to that, the Cambridge commentary. Quote, in the camp, it was necessary to keep the animals tied up, and most likely one part of the encampment was set apart for this purpose, and the terrified soldiers fled without a thought of going first to get their horses. In other words, they were so panicked, they just ran on foot. We're going to see later they left all their accoutrements behind them, scattered by the wayside as they ran. They were sprinting. They were really panicked. And of course, they didn't take time to strike their tents. That would take even longer than to get their horses. So we go now to 2 Kings chapter 7, verses 12 through 16. So the king got up in the night and said to his servants, let me tell you what the Arameans have done to us. They know we are starving, so they have left the camp to hide in the open country, thinking, when they come out of the city, when we, the Samaritans, the northern Israelites, come out of Samaria, we will take them, we, the Syrians, will take the Israelites alive and then go into the city. But one of his servants responded, please let messengers take 5 of the horses that are left in the city. Their fate is like the entire Israelite community who will die, so let's send them and see. The messengers took 2 chariots with horses, and the king sent them after the Aramean army, saying, go and see. So they followed them as far as the Jordan. This is the messengers of Joram followed the Syrian army as far as the Jordan River. They saw that the whole way was littered with clothes and equipment the Arameans had thrown off in their haste. The messengers returned and told the king. Then the people went out and plundered the Aramean camp. It was then that 6 quarts of fine meal sold for a shekel and 12 quarts of barley sold for a shekel, according to the word of the Lord. And by the way, I haven't said this because I've said it so many times in previous audios. The Arameans are the Syrians. It's just another way of saying Syria. Aram, A-R-A-M, is Syria. So in verse 12, the king got up in the middle of the night, having been told by his messengers that, hey, the Syrians are gone. And I've been assuming all along that this king is Joram, who ruled from 852 to 841. That's when Elisha prophesied most of the time. Now, Adam Clark says it's Ahab, who ruled from 874 to 853. Ahaziah, the 2-year wonder, was right in between the two kings. The first son of Ahab was Ahaziah. He fell through the lattice and died, and then Joram takes over. So it is possible that Elisha was operating at the very end of Ahab's reign, during Ahaziah's reign, and during Joram's reign. But most people say it's Joram. Gil says it's Joram. And so we're going to say it's Joram. It makes it easy. It makes it tidy. Now here's a little note on chronology from Adam Clark. Quote, in examining the facts recorded in these books, we shall always find it difficult and sometimes impossible to ascertain the exact chronology. Let me tell you, that's the absolute truth. I have spent hours trying to figure out what happened when. The difficulty, Clark continues, is increased by a custom common among these analysts, the giving the whole of a story at once, though several incidents took place at the distance of some years from the commencement of the story. As they seem, these analysts seem, unwilling to have to recur to the same history in the chronological order of its facts. What Clark is saying is, a lot of times, the writer, the author of the Book of Kings or any other Old Testament book, what they'll do is they'll give the chronology and then they'll interrupt the chronology and just start telling stories about what happened during that rough time frame. And that makes sense. It keeps the stories together. So we're not going to worry too much about what king was ruling when the prophet operated, but we're going to assume it's Joram. So Joram wakes up, he hears the news, he says, ah, this is a stratagem. They're trying to snooker us. They're hiding in the hills. We run out to get the food, and then we will be ambushed. So he's careful. He doesn't want to panic, which is smart. But the servants say, well, let's don't be too cautious, Joram. We got 5 horses here, and they're valuable, and we're starving to death, and we need horses, but hey, they're going to die anyway. If we send them out to the camp of the Arameans and the Arameans capture us, capture the messengers and capture the horses, we'll lose the horses. They'll die. But what's the difference? They're going to die anyway. So let's just go ahead and send them out there and see. That made sense. Joram said, okay, go see. So the messengers took 2 chariots. They took the 5 horses and they head to the Syrian camp. They see that the camp is deserted and then they keep going all the way to the Jordan River. And as they retrace the path of the retreating Syrian soldiers, they see that the whole way was littered with clothes and equipment the Arameans had thrown off in their haste because they thought they were going to die, and they didn't have horses, and they were running on foot, and so they were just throwing everything away so they could run faster. So the messengers returned and told the king. And so then the king says, hot dog, He tells the people it's safe, and so they all go running out, and they plunder the Aramean camp. And as they plunder the Aramean camp, all the goods from the camp, the food, comes into the city, and it's just a basic law of supply and demand. The supply goes up, the price goes down. So the price went down to where 6 quarts, that's Home of Christian Study Bible has 6 quarts. It's 1 measure, a siah, as the NIV has it. 1 measure of fine meal, 1 measure of wheat sold for a shekel. And remember, just yesterday, a donkey's head sold for 80 shekels. So you get 6 quarts of wheat for a shekel as opposed to having to spend 80 shekels to get a donkey's head yesterday. So the price has dropped precipitously. And 12 quarts of barley, that's 2 measures, each measure being about 6 quarts. So that's 2 measures of barley, the cheaper grain sold for a shekel. This is how you know that barley is half as expensive as wheat, or wheat is twice as expensive as barley, because one could buy twice as much barley with a shekel, 2 measures, as you could with wheat, 1 measure. But that's normal prices. And so the prices had gone down according to the word of the Lord. Of course, that's according to the prophecy that Elisha had given to Joram or Joram's messengers or to the elders in verses 1 and 2 of this chapter. We go now to 2 Kings 7, verses 17 through 20, and we will finish this audio. The king had appointed the captain, his right-hand man, to be in charge of the gate. This is the same captain that said, "What? Is God going to open the windows of heaven and work a miracle this big? No, it can't be." That's the same guy. The king had appointed him to be in charge of the gate, but the people trampled him in the gateway. Why had the captain been in charge of the gate? Well, to prevent disorder, rioting, as they rushed to get out the spoil, to get out of the city, to get the spoil, and it didn't work. The people are starving to death. They are riotous. They trample him in the gateway. He died. The text tells us in verse 17, just as the man of God had predicted when the king came to him. Now, this was in verses 1 and 2. Verses 1 and 2 are quoted word for word, basically, in 18, 19, and 20. So I'll read them again, verses 18, 19, and 20. When the man of God, this is referring back to the previous day, yesterday, when the man of God, Elisha, had said to the king, "About this time tomorrow, 12 quarts of barley will sell for a shekel, and 6 quarts of fine meal will sell for a shekel at the gate of Samaria." This captain had answered the man of God, "Look, even if the Lord were to make windows in heaven, could this really happen?" Elisha had said, "You will in fact see it with your own eyes, but you won't eat any of it." This is what happened to him. The people trampled him in the gateway and he died. Well, that shows that Elisha is a true prophet. If the man was speaking with arrogance and blasphemy, it also shows that God disciplined him and punished him for being cheeky, for being blasphemous. And as I said earlier, I don't know which way it was. Either way, Elisha is a great prophet and the people are saved. Great story. Ladies and gentlemen, we are now finished with 2 Kings 7. We will continue with the story of Elisha in our next audio, 2 Kings 8, verses 1 through 20, and we will see the Syrians hightailing it out of Samaria. Of course, they've already started in this chapter, but the story continues in the next chapter, and I hope you stay tuned for the rest of the story, and I hope you enjoyed this audio.